Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Sunday, April 28, 2024. I'm Anthony Davis. Welcome to The Weekend Show, where we make the time to consider the news of the week. You can support my work and independent journalism at patreon.com/5minutenews. Our guest today was appointed by President Barack Obama to serve as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She was the first woman to serve in her position. She now teaches criminal law, national security, and data privacy at the University of Michigan Law School, and is the author of the book Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Barbara McQuaid, welcome to The Weekend Show.
Thanks very much, Anthony. Great to be with you.
So we are in one of the probably the weirdest and most polarized periods of American political history, and so that there's no shortage of things to talk about. Your book explains the way disinformation is impacting democracy and fortunately offers some solutions that can be pursued to try and strengthen truth-based politics. But let's start with the First Amendment, which is not a privilege that we enjoy in my country of birth. Do you feel that unfiltered free speech has contributed to the polarized place that we find ourselves in now in the U.S.?
Yes, I actually think it is a distorted understanding of the First Amendment and what it protects that people sometimes weaponize and label as censorship any restrictions they don't like. Of course, you know, the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law abridging the right to free speech, but the way the courts have interpreted the First Amendment is along with other provisions of the Constitution. You know, you can't look at any of these provisions in isolation. There are also provisions that the government has to provide for the common defense. And so as a result, over the years, the Supreme Court has interpreted the First Amendment to mean that there can be some restrictions on it for time, place, or manner, for example. There's an old adage that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, right? Because that would create a public safety hazard for the people within that theater. And so it is possible to put limits on speech as long as they are narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling governmental interest. But I think that for some people who don't have a deep understanding of the First Amendment or don't want to, it's very convenient to say, I can say anything I want and you can't stop me. And I think it's that misunderstanding of the First Amendment that fuels a lot of the disinformation that we see today.
So in England, we have clear definition of hate speech versus free speech. And I think that's really the fundamental difference, isn't it? Unfortunately, hate speech here in the US has been used not just by the average troller online, but by the former president of the United States to demonize social groups, LGBTQ plus people, various communities, to the point that we found that hate crime rose substantially under his tenure. That is a problem, isn't it, when people in authority break the rules?
Absolutely, because it gives license to everyone else to do the same. I think you do hit at one of the challenges in our First Amendment, which I would suggest is an incredibly valuable piece of democracy. I think it's a right that's cherished by people on the left or on the right in this country, which is why anyone who runs afoul of it is looked at askance. So it makes it difficult, though, for prosecutors to criminalize things like hate speech unless it crosses the line into violent conduct. And so Donald Trump frequently will say things that he knows goes right up to the legal line without crossing it, even though it's abhorrent behavior to say some of these things. So the Supreme Court in 1969 decided a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio, where a member of the Ku Klux Klan was giving a very fiery speech, a hateful speech about Jewish people. But there, what the court held is you can't criminalize speech, even very ugly speech, unless it is intended to incite imminent lawless action and that the speech makes it likely that such action will result. And so to just spew hateful things and say, you know, this group is awful, or, you know, fill in your racist rant here, that alone cannot be criminalized. And so that can be very difficult. I remember when I was a prosecutor in the Eastern District of Michigan, we frequently got complaints about threats communicated online. And if there were simply things like, you know, all cops can go to hell, or all cops should die, or, you know, fill in a group there, you know, that alone was just too generalized and too vague to be a prosecutable threat. You had to have very specific conduct targeting a particular individual with violence, and that appeared to be imminent. And so it's often difficult to find all of those elements to be present. And I think Donald Trump knows how to use this tool expertly. He says things that are horrific, that are divisive in society, but don't go across that line that could be criminally charged based on an incitement theory.
So he knows what he's doing when he says this stuff. I mean, there's a lot of inferment, isn't there? And we found that with things like fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, these kind of subtle coded calls to action. So is this more about the people that hear these things and respond to these things? Because this is where the incitement issue is a problem. I mean, we're still seeing this with the whole January 6th case, right? Where, you know, he's standing up there and I'll go with you and you're not going to have a country left if you don't fight. You know, the people that argue his case say, well, he didn't specifically say go smash up the Capitol building. It's these gray areas that are a big problem for the country right now.
Yes, it can be very difficult. And, you know, I don't know that I'm advocating that that law be changed, because I do think the same laws that protect people from saying, who say awful things, also protect people who are perhaps in the minority and want to speak out against our government. But that doesn't mean that he's able to get away with anything. For example, he has been charged criminally with conspiracy to defraud the United States. And so the hateful rhetoric was all part of it. But where it's really a crime is deceiving people and trying to impede the peaceful transfer of presidential power. That is what makes that a crime. Or he's also been charged with conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding by preventing the certification of electors on January 6th. So there are ways to criminalize conduct, even if we cannot criminalize most forms of speech.
I find it so interesting that if you had to write a movie script about the president breaking every law, right, try everything from national security through just, you know, all the protocols that come with the role of president, that he really has, as we say in England, played a blinder. You were given your post by President Barack Obama. Just talk to me about the differences as you saw it between those two administrations and how America maybe has changed since the years of Trumpism.
Yes. And, you know, I don't say this from a place of politics, you know, Democrat versus Republican in any way. Although I was appointed by a Democratic president, I certainly worked to be very nonpartisan in my work. And I spent my career as a prosecutor working in multiple administrations. I started in the Clinton administration. I worked in the George W. Bush administration. And I worked in the Obama administration, and then even briefly in the Trump administration. And, you know, in most of those, in all of those administrations, up until the Trump administration, you know, presidents might have policy views that are different from each other, but they are acting in the best interests of the country as they believe them to be. And so one president might have, you know, be more hawkish on national security. Another president might care more deeply about civil rights. But those are policy preferences that they're entitled to advance based on their mandate from people who voted them into office. In the case of Donald Trump, I saw a bull in a china shop. It was someone without any regard to our institutions and who is seeking to bring down credibility from some of those institutions, attacking the courts, attacking the FBI, attacking the Justice Department, attacking the media, and attacking the civil service, you know, referring to them as the deep state and the media as the enemy of the people. All of these things are the same tactics used by authoritarians throughout history to undermine public confidence in the kinds of institutions that could serve as a check on them. Because if people lose confidence in those institutions, then when those institutions criticize the leader can say, see, I told you all along, those groups had no credibility and they were illegitimate. And so I saw that really from the start of the Trump administration, and is why I believe he was so dangerous to our national security as our president and potentially our future president.
The one of Trump's attorney generals, he had a few, Bill Barr. He was, I think, on Thursday announced that he would be endorsing Donald Trump for president, despite everything that went after him. Of course, he sneaked out the back door just a couple of weeks before the insurrection on January 6th, which was maybe a clever move on his part. But to quote Donald Trump's Truth Social post, he wrote, former AG Bill Barr, who let a lot of great people down by not investigating voter fraud in our country, has just endorsed me for president, despite the fact that I called him weak, slow-moving, lethargic, gutless, and lazy. I mean, this is not ideal, is it? That people with the standing such as Bill Barr, love him or hate him, is willing to endorse an insurrectionist and somebody who has very much, who he knows has upended the political system in the U.S.
No, and I think Bill Barr is a perfect example of this, Anthony. I think one of the real problems in our society right now is we are so polarized that people care more about winning than they care about integrity or democracy. And so Bill Barr, I think, is someone who sees the ends justifying the means. Remember, he is the one who dismissed the criminal charges against Michael Flynn for lying to the FBI about his conversations with a Russian diplomat during the transition. He is the one who filed a sentencing memo urging leniency for Roger Stone. And so, you know, he put a thumb on the scale for some of Trump's allies in a way that I think was something that also brought disrepute to the Justice Department and helped cause some of that loss of public confidence in the institution. But I think Bill Barr is a really interesting character. You know, he gave some speeches while he was Attorney General that I thought were very revealing into his worldview. And he revealed that he thought that, you know, the left was the greatest threat to our country and to national security, that, you know, issues like affirmative action against the LGBTQ community, issues like the separation of church and state. He saw those things as a threat to American society, and he wanted to go back to a time before we had reached what I consider progress in this country in advancing the goals of all of those causes. And so I think he saw himself as using Donald Trump to advance his vision of America. Instead, I think he realized he got used by Donald Trump, and he left before he would do the ultimate bad act in agreeing and going along with this fraud. That was a bridge too far. And yet he's willing to endorse Donald Trump. And again, I think it's because he cares more about the ends than the means. And when we choose our political tribe over truth, I think we have lost some of our power as a democracy. It may be that it's keeping his favorite party in power now, but the day may come when he sees people putting tribe above truth for the other side. And that I think he would find that that is not a place that we want to be as a country. I think if you're a lawyer, you care more about process than you do ultimate outcome. If you have good process, then the end, then in the end, most often you're going to have good outcomes.
So let's talk to this notion of democracy, which is something you keep coming back to in the book. Do you think people really know what it is? Because that's my concern, is that, you know, people are so keen to let it go. And I'm talking about, obviously, mostly MAGA Republicans and their representatives, that actually they really won't know what they've lost until it's actually gone.
Yes. In fact, there has been, I think, an assault, a very subtle assault on democracy in this country Senator Mike Lee of Utah, you know, has begun referring to us, saying we're not a democracy, we're a republic. And I suppose you could quibble and say we're a democratic republic or a Republican democracy, which means, you know, we elect representatives to make decisions in Congress. And that's all true. But, you know, he went further and said, you know, after all, democracy isn't the point. Prosperity is the point. Democracy is just a means to that end. And that's not the only means to that end. Whoa. Our country was founded on the idea of democracy. We broke free from a monarchy because we saw how damaging it can be when the people do not have the power to govern their own affairs. And we have always found that to be true. We have, Thomas Jefferson said, an informed electorate is necessary to a democracy and self-government. And so the idea that we would surrender some of that power, or we would agree to go along with the con when we know our leader is feeding us false information, it is really ceding some of that power of a democracy and the power of the people. I think that there are people who have a vision of America that was perhaps the vision of their childhood. Some people prefer an America that was dominated by white people, that was dominated by men, that was dominated by Christians. And they have seen in recent decades a loosening of that disparity, where we see now women having power, where we see members of the LGBTQ community having power, where we see multiple religions having power, and people of color rising in numbers in our population. And I think it frightens people. And I think that there are politicians who will use that fear against people and try to suggest that if these people are allowed to have power, you will lose power, and suggesting to them that if we allow the LGBTQ community to have equal rights under the law, they are grooming your children for pedophilia, you know, raising all of these irrational fears to try to hold on to their own power. And I think it's because the truth is, if working class white people understood what's really going on, they would revolt. And so you have to keep them apart from minorities because you can conquer them by dividing them. And so for lower class white people, if they start asking questions about why is it that I am not as well off economically now as my parents' generation, and the answer is because of corporate tax cuts, CEO salaries that are off the charts, jobs going overseas, all kinds of issues. But instead, what leaders tell them is the reason that you are worse off economically is because of those other people. I'm going to demonize others. It's the immigrants who are taking your job. It's the women who are taking your jobs. It's people of color who are taking their jobs under diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. That's who you should be mad at. And so I think it is a political tool that is used to manipulate people to vote against their own personal self-interest.
So fear has been weaponized. The media make money through advertising and everything else when they are ramping up the fear. And it's also very addictive from a viewer's perspective, isn't it? The idea that, you know, there's a countdown clock on the screen to some kind of doomsday event, that there's a level of jeopardy involved that really kind of hooks people in. Let's talk about that kind of the cultish nature of this, because we refer to Trump's base as a cult. I've started referring to the leadership as being in the cult as well. I mean, very few people have stood up to him and you know, some are quitting, but that's the best they can do. So what is it about this? Because, you know, morally, to blame minority groups and communities for something that is actually the responsibility of you know, corporate industry and price gouging and CEO salaries and everything else that you accurately describe, you have to be a real certain type of person to be able to play that long game. It's not a, you know, it doesn't help anybody really, does it? Nobody benefits from this situation. So how can we change that? Like, is there a solution to kind of putting the country back on track in terms of understanding the truth? Or are we just too far gone in terms of capitalism and misinformation?
Oh, no, I believe that there are solutions. In fact, I'm proud to say that the longest chapter in my book is a chapter about solutions. I think it starts by opening people's eyes to these tactics. I think that if we can identify the tactics and name the tactics, we can defeat them, because people will recognize the ways that they're being manipulated by these same tactics that have been used by Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin and others throughout our nation's history. So I think that's the first part of it. I think calling out these lies, you know, saying the emperor has no clothes, you know, these sycophants who are members of Congress and others, you know, calling them out and saying, you have no clothes. You know, Donald Trump has begun referring to some of the defendants in the January 6th case, people who committed violent acts on January 6th, assaulting police officers. He's begun calling them hostages, suggesting that they're somehow political prisoners. And now we've heard Congresswoman Elise Stefanik and Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene repeating that term of hostages. And, you know, the more you hear it, the more normalized it becomes, and it's in echo chambers. And then pretty soon people start to believe it. That is profoundly wrong conduct. They are deliberately deceiving the American people. I am certain that Elise Stefanik and Marjorie Taylor Greene don't believe for a minute that those people are hostages. That they're willing to go along with the con to advance their own political agenda. We need to call for civic virtue and truth in the debate about our issues. And those who are going along with the lies are traitors to our country, and we need to call them that. So I think that's the first step that we need to do. But I think there's some other things that we can do, Anthony. I mean, I think one is there are some regulations, I think, that we should look at seriously for social media. And I think we can do that without running afoul of the First Amendment. This is one of those areas where as soon as you begin to suggest regulation of social media, you get labeled a censor. You want to repeal the First Amendment. Like, no, I think there are a lot of things that can be done without running afoul of the First Amendment. Regulating algorithms, for example, as you talked about, there is this pressure to outrage, because the more outraged people are, the longer they stay online, and the longer they stay online, the more ads the social media platforms sell. That's what the Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen revealed when she testified before Congress. So why can't we regulate the algorithms, you know, the computer programs that decide what to lift up on your feed and what to lower? I think we could do that. I think we could also regulate the way our data is collected and scraped and sold to data brokers, who in turn sell them to commercial enterprises and to political consultants, that we have more power over our personal data that gets shared online. I think we could regulate bots that are online, you know, these AI generated accounts that look like a real person. They might have a name like Patriot Girl, and instead it's just a robot programmed to argue with you whenever it spots certain words, or it's there to amplify other claims of false information, so it looks more popular than it is and it reaches farther than it otherwise would. I think those are some things we can do. And I also think on the other side of the equation, kind of the user side, I think we could improve our own media literacy so that we are less susceptible to some of these manipulations. I think if we learn how to read with a skeptical eye, to demand a second source, to look to a story and pass the headline, I think there are a lot of things we can do to build our own resilience against disinformation.
Okay. We have to take a quick break. I want to come back and talk more with you in just a moment here on The Weekend Show.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base? How about businesses on Shopify? When we started podcasting, an online store was the furthest thing from our minds. Now we're selling t-shirts and Midas Touch merch, and it's so easy, all because we use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch of your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're delivering daily digests or serving sensational scoops, Shopify will help you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point-of-sale system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds and Rothney's and Brooklinen and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success at every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/weekend. Go to shopify.com/weekend now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/weekend.
We're back with Barb McQuaid here on The Weekend Show. I'm Anthony Davis. Donald Trump is in court in New York, and it's not going as well as he might have hoped in the last week or two. But I want to talk about something that happened outside the courtroom, and that was a man setting himself on fire in protest last week. Now, we don't know too many of the details. He was throwing some flyers out that made some reference to capitalism or something. But the point is that the rhetoric that we've just been talking about, the hate speech, eventually it's going to be converted into acts of violence, isn't it? And when we see something as dramatic as a self-immolation in the street, it which CNN carried live, unfortunately, it's something that we really have to almost like put the brakes on and say, hang on a second, you know, what is the effect of people like Donald Trump speaking in such unsavory language all the time? After a while, people at home are going to want to get up and do something about it, aren't they?
Absolutely. You know, when I worked as a national security prosecutor, one of the things that I spent a lot of time learning about was radicalization. And when, you know, Al-Qaeda was the top national security threat to the United States, and then ISIS was the top national security threat, one of their strategies was to reach out to young people online in an effort to radicalize them, to first stoke their anger and then to push them from anger to action and to commit crimes and kill as many people as you can wherever you are in the world. You know, how to make a bomb and how to use a vehicle for rammings to kill people and other kinds of things. You know, the rhetoric that we hear from Donald Trump and others is not so explicit about go kill people, but it is one level below that in terms of the amplifying the anger that is likely to turn into action. There's a term called stochastic terrorism, stochastic meaning random, and that is, I don't know who or where or when somebody might answer my call to action, but if I say enough hateful and insightful things, somebody out there is going to take the bait and is going to act. And we've already seen other actions of this. Now, I don't know about the man who set himself on fire and what his precise motivation was, but we do know that others have been motivated. For example, there was a man named Cesar Sayoc, known as the pipe bomber. He is a man who was a big supporter of Donald Trump, and he had a van adorned with stickers praising Donald Trump and opposing some of his political rivals and the media. And he sent pipe bombs through the mail to members of the media and prominent members of the Democratic Party. Fortunately, no one was injured, but those went through mailrooms, through the U.S. Postal Service, and to the doors of some of these places. We know that there was another man who, after the search warrant by the FBI at Mar-a-Lago, and after Donald Trump accused them falsely of planting evidence, there was a man in Cincinnati who posted online that great patriots must take action against the FBI. And that man went to the FBI office in Cincinnati with an assault weapon. He was chased away and later killed in a standoff with police. And then finally, you know, Nancy Pelosi, her husband, was attacked in their home by an intruder with a hammer. We don't know all of the things he had seen before, but after years and years of television ads by Republicans casting Nancy Pelosi as the devil and showing her in flames and saying, fire Nancy, and all these kinds of things, is it surprising that there's somebody out there who's a bit unhinged, who sees this and decides they're going to take the law into their own hands? And I think that's one of the real dangers of this escalating level of this threat environment.
But the people that say these things, they're not making the connection, are they? Then they're not taking the responsibility. I mean, that's what worries me, you know, that this idea that you can be completely free of speech and there be consequences and still not be able to join the dots and realize that there are consequences to your language.
Yes. I mean, I think it's incredibly reckless when people engage in this kind of rhetoric where they know, especially, you know, here's some of the things Donald Trump has been doing, targeting witnesses in the cases against him, targeting judges, targeting jurors, targeting court staff. He's got to know, based on this track record we just discussed, that it is highly likely that there is someone out there who is unhinged, who will hear that rhetoric as a call to action to do something against some of those individuals, to be a hero in the eyes of their hero, Donald Trump. So it's incredibly irresponsible to say those kinds of things and engage in that kind of rhetoric. But there's really no crime for that. Now, Is there accountability? I think so. I think some of that accountability comes at the ballot box. Voters can see that behavior and say, this is unacceptable for a leader, someone we want to hold out as the leader of all of the American people. It's stunning to me that there are so many people who call themselves Christians, which is my faith, who are supportive of Donald Trump when he engages in such incredibly anti-Christian behavior. But that's beside the point. We separate church and state in this country. I think just as a matter of civic virtue, to see someone behave like that is, to me, completely unqualified and unfit to serve in public office.
Is it time to change the rhetoric, though? Because you say we separate church and state, and you're right, we did, but we don't anymore. And certainly many of the Republican leaders who have spoken about this, including Mike Johnson, the current Speaker of the House, does not believe in the separation of church and state, nor does Marjorie Taylor Greene or any of these kind of former Freedom Caucus members. So there's that. There's also the argument that, you know, we talk about being in fear of the fall of democracy. I come in looking at this through a European lens, I guess, and I'm like, well, are you kidding me? Democracy already fell. You know, okay, it's still one of the safest places to vote on the planet. But in terms of people's understanding of it, you know, Donald Trump is absolutely going to say that this next election in November is rigged and there's fraud and all this stuff if he loses. If he wins, he probably won't say any of that stuff. But,
yeah,
but is it time for Americans to kind of start changing that kind of the language about this and realize that the threat is not just imminent, but it already came and went?
Well, I'm not really ready to concede defeat, I suppose, for democracy. But I know sometimes there is this argument that you have to fight fire with fire and, you know, promote your side and use the same tactics the other side is using. And I'm not a believer in that. I think that the goal isn't for Republicans or Democrats to win. The goal is for the democratic process to win. And if the democratic process wins, then I think ultimately we will have the best people in office. And so to have integrity in the process requires truth in debate. It requires a recognition of the separation of church and state. I mean, America was founded on the idea of religious liberty. People who were persecuted for not adhering to the state-sponsored religion came to this country seeking religious freedom. And so it's a really absurd notion. And, you know, our boundaries get tested as we become a more diverse nation, as we have people who come from other countries, and if we have more people who have different faith traditions, perhaps it challenges those original premises. But if we're going to be a strong country, we have to figure out a way to live together and work together in the society. And I think we can do that. But I think one of the challenges we face right now is that both political parties, and I'm not fond of both sidesing most issues because I don't think there's often a both sides to someone who seeks to overturn democracy. But I do think both sides have been guilty of becoming more polarized by using as a political strategy an appeal to their base. There used to be a time when both parties would tack toward the middle as we approached a general election, seeking to persuade the middle, the swing voter. And now, since the mid-90s, in a strategy developed by Karl Rove during the George W. Bush administration, what we see instead is an effort to tack toward the base. So the right's going to tack farther right, the left's going to tack farther left. And as a result, there's no room in the middle. And we tend to be identifying with our political tribes as opposed to thinking about each issue individually and independently. I mean, I can remember a time when you could have a variety of views on issues like guns and abortion and affirmative action and tax policy and immigration. And now it seems you need to line up with your party on all of those issues. I mean, you know, many of my friends who are, devout Christians and Republicans are suddenly gun nuts. What? Where did that come from? And it's because their party has told them so, that is where we stand on guns. And so you better get in line. Because if you don't get in line in this world of social media, you will be castigated as a traitor or as other, because the parties now demand political purity. And if we demand political purity, we're never going to get anything done. We have to be willing to set aside some of our policy preferences so that we can advance society. Compromise is the only way we can get things done. I mean, that is the art of politics, is all about compromise. And instead, I think we find ourselves in this place where what we care about is the ultimate goals of our party versus having a process with integrity.
But as you say, only one party is advocating for democracy. when Trump has claimed that dictatorship is actually his MO, and he's looking up to Kim Jong and to Xi Jinping and to Vladimir Putin and Viktor Orban and all of these characters that we were only thinking a few years ago were foes of the United States. How did these leaders, these dictators or autocrats, how has the narrative changed so easily from them being a foe to a friend as far as the MAGA Republicans see them?
Yeah, it's really difficult to understand and to get my head around that. Vladimir Putin, for example, Tucker Carlson, the far right journalist, did some, loving piece on Putin and on Russia, and even showed viewers in America how, glistening the grocery stores are. Look how great it is here. And asking, ask yourself, what did Putin ever do to me? Did Putin ever call me a racist? I mean, it's really just bizarre to me. You say if they aren't being influenced by Putin, it sure looks like they are. But perhaps it is just because there is a mutual admiration for strength, for using authoritarian power to impose your will on the people, for caring more about the results than about the process, for clinging to traditional values, religious values and family values, making no room or place for the LGBTQ community or for immigrants to your society. Maybe it's as simple as that, but it is bizarre to me that, a group that Ronald Reagan, demanded to tear down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. The idea that side of the world is now the ally is really bizarre to me. But I think it comes down to this idea that we don't really care about process. What we really want is results. And even if that means having a dictator in charge.
But it's quite a stretch, isn't it, to say that a dictator or Putin's Russia is like traditional family values when he's disappearing people off the streets, he's imprisoning his political opponent. And, do you think Donald Trump even realizes that in his, bromance with Kim Jong, that Kim Jong just arrests the entire family of somebody who might steal from a store? I mean, do you think he recognizes the extent of the human rights atrocities of China, for example? Because, it's quite a moral shift to be able to ignore all that stuff just for political purposes.
Yeah, I think he doesn't care. I think that Donald Trump will say whatever he thinks he needs to say to advance his own agenda. And I think he admires the strength of those leaders and the power that they have to just use brute force to get their own way. And I think he envies that power. In the United States, we have all kinds of checks and balances to ensure that we are protected from abuse of power. And I think he would like to operate in a system that didn't have those checks and balances, because then he could just do whatever it is he wants and he wouldn't have to worry about the pesky press or Congress having oversight hearings or other kinds of things designed to protect us from that kind of abuse and overreach. And so most presidents understand the role of the press. They may find them to be a nuisance from time to time, but they understand the importance. Most presidents understand the important role that Congress plays, even though they might from time to time have disputes on them with them over various issues. Donald Trump makes no bones about the idea that he has great problems with all of these institutions, including people within his own administration, whom he calls the deep state, who might dare to check him. The career civil servants who run our environmental laws, run our Centers for Disease Control, run our nuclear program, run our power grid. All of these people we rely on throughout administration to administration, regardless of political power. He wants to oust them and replace them all with political appointees under something he calls Schedule F to the Civil Service Act, because he doesn't want the inconvenience of checks and balances.
It's like how he ran the Trump Organization. It was just him and his family and Alan Weisselberg. I mean, there wasn't really many staff members running this because Donald Trump needed to control everything. And I suppose that's why somebody like him is so unsuited for a public service role where it requires delegation and collaboration and those checks and balances that you describe.
Yes, you know, there are some people who are very fond of saying they want to run government like a business.
Yeah,
I think it has some superficial appeal, right? Because you can't spend beyond your means and you have to be fiscally responsible and you can't have excessive red tape and things like that. Maybe it has some superficial appeal there. But of course, a business is completely different from government because a business is in the business of business, making money. And government is in the business of serving the people. And so those are two very different things. This was really brought home to me as a citizen of the state of Michigan when we endured the Flint water crisis. You may recall that the city of Flint, which was in some dire financial straits, decided that in an effort to save money, they would change their water supply from the Detroit River to the Flint River, which was closer because it cost too much money for them to use water from the Detroit River. Well, when they did so, they botched it. They had a lot of people who were not well-trained, didn't do the things right. And so it resulted in the water not being properly treated with chemicals. And so it picked up all of the lead that's in the pipes and poisoned children and other people living in the city of Flint. To me, that was a myopic focus on the bottom line without thinking about what's in the best interest of the people. And it's why government should not be run like a business. And I agree with you. I think it's why Donald Trump is particularly ill-suited to serving in government. He has no government experience, and he wasn't in a publicly traded company, which brings with it scrutiny of shareholders and public reporting and compliance issues. Instead, it's a private business. He was the boss, and he told people what to do, and everybody did what he said to do. And now we are seeing, without regard to ethics or sometimes compliance with the law.
But it's not just Trump, is it? Because, I mean, you know, the water crisis in Flint is actually a much bigger crisis. And we've seen Joe Biden in the last week talking about PFAS and these other kind of components of poisons in the water. In fact, I checked my own water supply and there was more, I think 800 times more arsenic than is acceptable. So I'm now drinking filtered. But the point is that the MAGA Republicans in Congress, they all voted against any of these bills to, you know, support the EPA. In fact, the EPA was gutted under Donald Trump. And this is the tragedy of the bigger picture is that, you know, yes, Trump is this leader, but Trumpism has now filtered very much into the wider leadership. Even Mitch McConnell is endorsing Donald Trump.
Yes, I think that for business leaders, there is an unhappy alliance, a willingness to put Trump into power because they see it as being in their financial best interest. And so for someone who's going to cut their taxes and also deregulate, even at the peril of the American people, that butters their bread. And so they are willing to hold their nose and vote for him and endorse him and put him in office because they believe that he will advance their short-term financial interests. I think that's a very selfish way to look at the world, a very selfish way to look at governing. Thinking about the immediate short-term benefits to you at the expense of the long-term cost to the American people and possibly the collapse of democracy. But, you know, this is the issue when it comes to climate change, when it comes to responding to COVID-19 and many other issues. I think there are people who care more about their financial best interest than they do the best interests of the country. And that's unfortunate. Ruth Ben-Ghiat has a wonderful book called Strong Men. Perhaps you've read it, that talks about the history linking Donald Trump to some of these authoritarians throughout history. And one of the things she said is they can't take power by themselves. They need powerful allies to get themselves there. And one way they do it is by benefiting the business elite to help let them in. And then once they're there, they have to reward them for their loyalty. And so I think that's what we're seeing right now.
It's always follow the money, isn't it? And Ruth's been on this show three times, I think, now, and has explained it better than many people do, because this nature of the strong man, it's like history repeats itself because there is this weird attraction to the strong man, even to the point that Trump supporters now at rallies, when interviewed, they say, well, actually, maybe we do want a dictator.
Yes. And you know, he has joked that he'd like to be a dictator for a day. And I think these jokes are very much a strategy of normalizing certain vocabulary. If it comes out first as a joke and then people begin to repeat the joke, after a while, it doesn't sound so strange anymore or so absurd anymore that, yeah, what's wrong with having a dictator? That'd be pretty good, wouldn't it? To have a strong leader who's on our side. again, it comes back to this idea that we're going to win and we're going to be on the upside. Well, that's true for a while, but you know, the old quote, like first they came for the laborers and then they came for the unions and then they came for, and then they came for me and there's no one to speak for me. So, you know, watch your step before they come for you.
Okay. Let's take another quick break. We'll come back and do more with Barb McQuaid next. Have you ever wished that you had a whiter and brighter smile? Well, before you visit a dentist, you should know that their whitening treatments can be very expensive, and it's not just the price. You also have to book the appointment and schedule time away from work and family to sit in a dentist's office chair while undergoing the procedure. It's a hassle. Fortunately, now you can try Smile Actives at home or anywhere, anytime. Smile Actives offers a safe and affordable alternative to those expensive whitening procedures. I myself had a whitening procedure in the dentist chair several years ago. It was kind of painful, I didn't really enjoy it, and it didn't seem to last. Well, 97% of Smile Actives users in a clinical trial reported up to 6 shades whiter on average, all within 30 days. Simply add Smile Actives Pro Whitening Gel to your regular toothpaste. It's been formulated with PolyClean technology to boost stain removal and deliver active whitening ingredients into teeth's grooves and crannies to get better whitening. Smile Actives makes a teeth whitening gel that can simply be added to your toothpaste every time you brush your teeth. So no change in your routine, no extra time, and no more messy strips or trays or lights. People will start commenting on your whiter, brighter smile in just days. Smile Actives is the whitening boost your favorite toothpaste needs to give you the smile you deserve. Visit smileactives.com/weekend today to receive a special buy one, get one free offer with auto delivery, plus free shipping and handling. That's smileactives.com/weekend. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We're back on the Weekend Show. Donald Trump is facing his first criminal court case right now, and he's not enjoying the experience, not enjoying being in a dingy New York courtroom. It's very cold. He keeps falling asleep. And, you know, he at the end of every day kind of comes out and makes some misinformation statement about what went on. In fact, he even pretended that he'd stormed out of the courtroom the other day when, of course, he hadn't. But, you know, I think we're getting used to this. And I also think that, you know, talking about the strong man, he doesn't look like the strong man in that courtroom. And when he comes out, he's tired and disheveled. And, you know, he can't really speak coherently. And so maybe there is a slow diminishing of that strongman happening live on television, which I think could only be a good thing. But I want to talk to Trump and national security and your expertise in this, because one of the cases that we haven't got to yet, because of courtesy of Judge Eileen Cannon, who's a Trump-appointed judge in Florida, is the stolen classified documents case. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that just Trump just stole them from the White House and kept them, but he shared them and showed them around. An Australian businessman came clean about, you know, this and a plan to attack Iran and other things. Just how serious is that case? Because obviously we tend to try and rank these cases. And when we thought that this current one, the hush money or election interference one, was the least effectual, it's actually turning out to be quite powerful. But for my money, the stolen documents one really is just a very, very serious story, especially in the lead up to a general election where Trump is the Republican candidate.
Absolutely. The threat to the national security cannot be overstated about the way Donald Trump stored and retained these documents. You may recall that when agents came with a search warrant, they found some in a ballroom. They found some in a bathroom. They found some spilled out on the floor. And these aren't just any classified documents. These are documents relating to the national defense. Of course, they're not able to describe in detail what's contained in these documents, but these are the kinds of things that our military relies on, created by them to talk about things like, we know broad categories about some of the vulnerabilities of the United States, some of our own plans for retaliation, for strikes against our allies in Europe, some of our capabilities in our nuclear arsenal. I mean, these are unbelievably delicate secrets that we must safeguard from our adversaries, or else we lose all advantage that we have in those areas. They're incredibly dangerous. And we also know that Mar-a-Lago is a place that is targeted. It is open to the public on many occasions for special events. There have been people arrested for trying to enter there or come in with thumb drives in an effort to steal documents off of computers. So it's a really vulnerable target. So the recklessness of behaving in this way is absolutely astonishing. And yet Donald Trump persists in saying that he had every right to keep these documents. Of course, the stories haven't been consistent. First, it was that the FBI planted these documents in his home. Then it was he had every right to do so. But as we also know from that indictment and the charges against some of his co-defendants, there was an effort by Donald Trump to obstruct the investigation by moving some of the boxes out of the basement and storage room before his own lawyer came to look through them. He was trying to dupe his own lawyer into saying, I've reviewed them all. You've got everything. Here you go. And, you know, some of these documents were actually found in Donald Trump's desk in his personal office. And so a really serious case. I think that under normal circumstances, this case would have gone to trial quickly. And I think, of course, you never know what's going to happen at a trial, and every defendant is presumed innocent and is entitled to due process. But the evidence is very strong, and I'd be surprised if there were not a swift conviction in this case. But instead, we have Judge Aileen Cannon here, who has really been slow walking this case. I don't know why. Perhaps the worst, we can assume the worst about her, which is she is a politically ambitious judge who does not want to run afoul against of Donald Trump or his supporters, or that she's just incompetent, she's inexperienced, she's afraid. I don't know what it is, but for whatever reason, this case has been moving very slowly and is not likely to come to trial before the election, which I think is unfortunate because I think this case would really lay bare why this man is unqualified to serve as the commander-in-chief of our armed services and the president of the United States.
We keep coming up against this issue of politics meddling in the judiciary, getting in the way, political judges, not just Aileen Cannon, but the Supreme Court, which is now a stacked far-right Christian conservative court. And this week we were hearing their decision about Trump's immunity. I mean, the fact that he would want to take absolute immunity to the Supreme Court says a lot about his character and about his understanding of the democratic system. But the fact that the Chief Justice Roberts is willing to hear this, hasn't just batted it away, but is actually willing to hear this. What does that say to you about the checks and balances that are supposedly in place to prevent the rise of somebody like Donald Trump as a dictator?
Well, I have been concerned about some of the individual justices on the court, but I still think that our courts are one of the most important bulwarks against some abuses of power. And I think in this case, the reason the court was willing to take it up is not so much about this case, but about future cases. In fact, even Justice Kavanaugh said, I'm not so worried about this case, but we're writing for the future. And that, I think, is an interesting point. It suggests to me that perhaps the court is going to rule in favor of Special Counsel Jack Smith, although it could be that they build in some delay, because what they seem to be struggling with is, where do we draw that line between protected conduct, for which a president is immune, you know, official conduct that is committed in the best interests of the United States, dropping a bomb on Hiroshima, for example, or President Obama using a drone strike to take out an American citizen who is engaging in acts of terrorism overseas. Can his successor charge him with a crime? And there needs to be some immunity for some of those acts, some of those core constitutional functions of the presidency. But I think everybody agrees that what Donald Trump is charged with in this case is not that. Interfering with a state election is well beyond the bounds of presidential power. And so I think what they will ultimately do is decide, you know, here's the line. We call it, you know, official versus unofficial acts, or when someone's acting as an office holder versus an office seeker, we're going to draw the line there. And that seems fine. What I worry about is that they are going to remand this case to the lower court for findings as to which of these allegations, which side of the line they fall on, and then that they'll permit Donald Trump to appeal that finding, resulting in further delays. I think ultimately, unless he becomes president and derails this case, that this case will go to trial and he will be convicted. The problem, of course, is that if he becomes president in the meantime, I am reasonably sure he will appoint an attorney general who will dismiss this case.
There is a feeling in the U.S. that the
that executive branch and that certainly that office of president is something that is so sacred that you can't really imprison someone like that. A lot of people take this opinion, and that's why a lot of the judges, including Judge Ngoron, who could have thrown Trump in a cell overnight for his abuse of the gag order, for example, that they're really treating this with kid gloves. But the law is catching up. And in fact, on Wednesday, an Arizona grand jury indicted a whole bunch of Trump allies, yes, including Rudy Giuliani, over this fake elector scheme, which is really the kind of linchpin of the coup, right? Just talk to me about the notion that it's more dangerous to put Trump in prison than to actually kind of have him go through the process properly for fear of the ramifications of his supporters, who invariably are armed to the teeth and are almost waiting for a second civil war.
Yes, I think it's really difficult. You know, Donald Trump has repeatedly violated these gag orders that have been put in place by Judge Ngoron, Judge Mershon, some of these other judges, and they seem very reluctant to jail him. I think if you or I were violating gag orders with impunity like that, they would tell us, bring your toothbrush when you come to court tomorrow. Right. And yet we see a real reluctance with Donald Trump. I think that is why. I think, you know, on the one hand, they don't want to allow him to be able to flout these orders with impunity. On the other, if they jail him, perhaps they're giving him what he wants. He does seem to be baiting them almost,
yes,
to empower his followers to be outraged and be radicalized and go from anger to action. I think that's a worry. But I'm often reminded of the words of Janet Reno when she was the attorney general, who said words to the effect of, you know, sometimes you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And when you find yourself in that situation, the best thing to do is to do the right thing, because you're going to be criticized either way. And so I think the right thing is ultimately that if he continues to flout these orders, then he ought to be jailed just like everybody else.
His security detail and the FBI were planning earlier in the week for how they might handle it. In the event of him being jailed, I mean, how is it even possible? There is no precedent for this.
Nope, I don't know. But I think they can work it out. You know, the Secret Service doesn't really have the power to say a former president can never be jailed. Their job is to protect him wherever he is. So I think maybe they could craft some certain things, you know, a solitary confinement situation. Maybe they decide they're going to hold him in a federal facility where they can be sure that the place is safer as opposed to the local jail or Rikers Island or someplace like that. And that's fine. You know, I'm sure there's a federal holding facility that they've got that they can be assured he will be safe at, but he will be confined. And I think that might be the solution.
Finally, let's talk about hope, which was very much a theme of Barack Obama's campaign. Where are you now in terms of, you know, getting democracy back on track, the fall of Trumpism, maybe? Do you have hope for the US going forward? Because it's in a sticky place right now. No one can deny that. And this is probably the most important election ever. Would you not agree?
I agree. And, you know, I do have hope. I have hope because of our history. We've come back before from great adversity, from the Civil War, two world wars, the Great Depression, the Jim Crow South. We've been able to come up away from bad situations before by working together collectively toward unity. I think we've been in a really rough place for a long time, and I think people are tired of it. And so I am hopeful that people understand what's at stake in this election. And I think that as we watch these trials unfold over the summer, this current Trump trial and perhaps another, people are going to get a real sense of just what Donald Trump is about and who he is. And so his base will always be supportive of him, and there will be others who are never supportive of him. But, you know, it's those people in the middle who matter. And I think this time around, they understand what's at stake. So I have great hope that they are the ones who are going to save America.
Okay. Barbara McQuaid, thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
I'm Anthony Davis. Don't forget to support me and independent journalism at patreon.com/5minutenews. Download the 5-Minute News podcast. Join me next week with a brand new special guest and more factual news to discuss on the 5-Minute News Weekend Show with Midas Touch.
I'm out. Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.